Terrific. Well, welcome everyone. I'm Beth Brook, Global Vice Chair with Ernst & Young, and it is my absolute pleasure to sponsor this as Ernst & Young, to be here for the third consecutive year to sponsor the Business and Society track here at the Aspen Ideas Festival. And we are really excited to be part of a dialogue that helps to inform and enlighten us on some of today's biggest issues and challenges. Last year at the festival, we talked in a session a lot about the need for a focus on longer-term horizons when evaluating corporate financials and how do we get over the short-termism. This year, we're looking more closely at how companies are downplaying short-term results and how some companies are actually organizing differently to do so and to make that happen. And we're also discussing how to educate ourselves and to motivate people and shareholders to take a longer-term view. So, this afternoon, we're very fortunate to have some of the sharpest minds to share their insights with us and their experience in the changing nature of the firm. So, thanks to the Aspen Institute for putting together such a distinguished panel and program this afternoon. Your moderator is going to be Judy Samuelson of the Aspen Institute and the Business and Society program at the Aspen Institute. And it will be she's focused on this topic for some time. I've worked with her for a long time on this, and so we are in good hands for the afternoon with her in moderation. And so, Judy, we'll hand the program over to you and get started.
Let me start also by thanking E&Y for sponsoring this particular session and the whole Business and Society track. And thanks to all of you for being here. It's not for the faint of heart turning out on a warm summer afternoon and talking about theory of the firm. So we were all wondering whether or not it would just be the six of us talking to one another today. So we're actually thrilled you're all here. I personally think that this is the most important topic any of us could be talking about. I don't care if we're talking about global warming in one room, if we're talking about global development in another room, if we're talking about sustainable fisheries or poverty or the future of our education system. It is the firm, from our vantage point, that has become a very dominant, and in many cases, the most important institution on the ground. And so it is of concern to many of us, all of us, I would like to say, that firms be organized in such a fashion that, in fact, they're contributing day in and day out to the commons. And so that's what this panel is really about. It's understanding what kinds of ideas are emerging, how we got to the point that we are now, where short-termism seems to be abundant and driving behaviors that don't always contribute to the long-term progress of society. Not everybody on the panel will agree to that. That's why we're at the Aspen Institute. And so we look forward to having an engaging conversation, and I'm pleased as Beth noted, we have really the cream of the crop here today in terms of being able to set the context for this conversation. And I'm going to briefly introduce the panelists. You have more complete bios in your packets. From the far left, we're joined by Barry Lynn, who is both a journalist and author recently of the book End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation, which I think it was it the Washington Post said that Barry Lynn is Tom Friedman for adults. Barry's work examines corporate power and the effect on both policy and economy and has much to say on this topic. Next to him is Mike Jensen. Many of you know Mike is professor of business at Harvard Business School. Founder, one of my favorite things that he has done is the founder of SSRN, which is really facilitating the exchange of working papers before they get into the tenure mill, and is making it possible for faculty and academics who are looking at new issues in the business world to be able to bring light to their work and learn from one another. And that's been a fabulous investment that he's made in a remarkably successful website. But he has, of course, been generating ideas during the course of his career, and is particularly noteworthy as the work he's been doing on executive pay and what to do about it, and has a book himself coming out in 2008 on this topic. And then third, from your right, of course, is Lynn Stout. You can identify her because she is the only woman. She is one of the only women in the business track, we have to say. We're going to work on this one. Lynn is professor of corporate and securities law at UCLA, my alma mater. She's also, importantly, from where we sit, the principal investigator of a body of work that's been supported over several years from the by the Sloan Foundation that really looks at business organizations as organizations and how they actually function. And her contributions to this field are many. And then we have Bob Monks, who a true expert in corporate governance, author of numerous books on corporate governance. I think of him as kind of a corporate governance entrepreneur. He has created more institutions that have created information and contributed to debate and exchange of knowledge about corporate governance than just about anybody out there, including being the founder of ISS and many people say the father of modern shareholder activism. So we're delighted that he's with us today. And then finally, closest to me is Damon Silvers, who is Associate General Counsel of the AFL-CIO, a member, proudly, of the Aspen Corporate Value Strategy Group, which we lead out of the Business and Society Program at Aspen, and which is really dedicated to turning the corner on short-termism and understanding the pieces that need to be in place to do that. He's also, I think of as, he's on the PCAOB, the Public Company Accounting Oversight Board, advisory board, and I really think is the real chief spokesperson for the labor movement on the complex set of issues that fall under the domain of business and business corporate governance. So we welcome all five of you. Let me tell you a little bit what we're going to do here. We only have an hour and 10 minutes remaining. What we're going to do is do a very quick tutorial on the theory of the firm, how we got there. Lynn is going to share a few slides to do that. She's promised me to stay under 10 minutes. I'm cutting her off if that's not the case. She knows this. But just to kind of get everybody on the same page about where we got to this point, and then we're going to open it up and go through a few questions. It's going to be fairly informal, and we're also delighted to hear from all of you. I know we also have a lot of expertise in the room, so we'll try to mix it up as soon as we've had some opening thoughts from each of the panelists. So welcome again, and Lynn, do you want to take it from here?
Thank you, and thank you very much for that introduction, Judy. I'm going to do just a few slides, so since I don't want Bob and Damon to be blinded by the light, if you want to make yourselves comfortable. And I'm going to show our audience a chart that is viewed by pretty much every economics major, every business school student, every law student in the country at some point in their educational careers. And it's supposed to be a chart that describes corporations. I'm going to call it the principal agent model. But it's an idea you've probably run into. The most important thing about this chart is that the shareholders are on the top, and the corporation is somewhere down below them. And down at the bottom are these other people, customers, executives, employees, creditors. Why are at the bottom? Well, the theory is that corporations are owned by shareholders. How many people have heard shareholders described as the owners of corporations? All of us. And what goes along with that idea very frequently is the idea that the purpose of the corporation is to make as much money for shareholders as possible, and when in doubt, it's the shareholders who should decide what the corporation does. And what I want to suggest is that this may be a good description of some firms, particularly firms that have a single shareholder, but it's not at all a good description of what we tend to think of when we think of corporations, when we think of the Coca-Colas, the GEs, the Enrons, the Toyotas. For those corporations, this picture of what the corporation is all about is, I'm going to suggest, maybe not capturing the reality. But before I get there, I just want to show you this lovely cartoon that I got from one of Bob Monk's institutions that I believe he founded, the Corporate Library. And it's a picture of the shareholder as superhero. He's got the big S on his shirt. And as you can see, he's once a mild-mannered investor. Now he's going after corporate villains most foul. And he's the hero for our time battling corruption. This view of the public corporation as being owned by shareholders and is ultimately subject to shareholders' control has also led to this view that the best way to fix whatever's wrong with a corporation, whether it's socially responsibility or Enron, is to give shareholders more power. Okay, here's the problem with that notion. It doesn't describe business reality. And I'm going to take 5 of my 10 minutes to go over the details of why it doesn't describe business reality. But before I get there, I just want to talk a little bit about what we should do when we've got a theory that doesn't describe reality. Thomas Kuhn said in The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, when you've got a theory that fails to predict what we see, it's time to go back and think about whether the theory's right. And he gives the following example. People used to think the Earth was flat. Well, if you think the Earth is flat, when you're watching the sailboat sail out to sea, your prediction is it's going to get smaller and smaller and smaller, but it's not going to disappear. It's just going to get smaller and smaller and smaller. Well, luckily, at some point, someone noticed that when ships actually sailed out to sea, not only did they get smaller, but they began to drop below the horizon. So they said, you know, there's something missing from our flat Earth theory. What could it be? Now, I did have one corporate governance professor at Harvard suggest to me jokingly that maybe the ships were being eaten by sharks. That's a possibility. The other possibility is perhaps the Earth is curved after all and the ship is dropping out of sight. Okay, but the point is that we do learn when we have theories that don't describe reality. That's an occasion for us to start thinking a little bit more carefully about what's going on with the theory. Okay, let me talk a little bit. Okay, here's the hard part. I'm sorry, this is where you really pay. No good deed goes unpunished for showing up today. Let me just tell you about some of the many ways in which our theory of the public corporation doesn't map onto reality. And actually, at this point, I get to sort of say, finally, I'm a law professor. I actually have expertise that matters. So the first thing I'm going to tell you is that as a matter of law, shareholders don't own corporations. They own something called stock. And their rights are very carefully limited and delineated by the provisions of their certificates. Corporations are legal entities, which means they own themselves, just as you own yourself. So we've got the first problem with the shareholder ownership theory. Another problem is that one of the things that usually goes along with the idea that shareholders are the owners of the firm, or at least that firms should be run for shareholders' benefit, is this idea that shareholders are what economists call the sole residual claimant, meaning that everybody else gets what their contracts demand and not a penny more, which is why in my first chart, the creditors, the employees, you know, Damon's people, and you mean executives, you CEOs, right? You've got some okay. I know we've got some CEOs here in the crowd. You're just hired hands. You're just widgets, you CEOs. You're not important to the company. You're not residual claimants. You get what your contract provides, nothing more. Every single penny of profit that the firm makes should go to the shareholders. Another idea that goes along with this is that shareholders are the principals of the firm. Well, again, I get to put on my law professor hat and say, no, they're not. At law, a principal gets to tell the agent what to do. And the interesting thing about public corporations is that, and again, this is sort of the nitty-gritty of corporate law, but it turns out...
Don't touch this with the papers.
Okay, that will help. It turns out, at corporate law, that corporations are actually controlled not by shareholders, but by these things called boards of directors, right? These eight men or women or whatever number it is who meet somewhere between 4 and 12 times a year. And by law, they don't have to listen to the shareholders. If every shareholder in, say, GE, delivered a letter saying, pay us a dividend, at law, the CEO and the board of GE can say, nope, we don't want to. We want to spend our money on something else this year. And that's very interesting and very important. Now, it is true that shareholders can vote the board of directors out if they can get their act together. That is a huge if, and I'm going to talk about it some more in a few minutes. But the idea... Okay, we're there. Okay. Here we say, under this theory, you'd think shareholders would want control over their corporate boards. Turns out, when it comes to buying stock, they don't seem to care. See Google, most successful IPO ever, perhaps? Public shareholders completely without power because Page and Brin kept all the voting stock for themselves. So when it comes to putting their money up, investors don't seem to care that much about power of directors. Finally, well, I'm going to leave it to you folks who probably have spent more time in the corporate world than I have, but from what I've seen of corporations, at least until recently, they didn't seem to be all that concerned about maximizing shareholder wealth. Boards of directors seem much more interested in making sure the firm survived and that it grew. So that the reality is, and I'm almost there, if we want to look at shareholders, they're not the hero with the big S on the shirt. This is the hero they really are. You classics majors, that's our friend Ulysses. You may remember the story. That's our shareholder hero. And he's bound to the mast, and these people rowing the boat, they're the directors, right? And the story, of course, is from Ulysses and the Siren. Ulysses had his sailors bind himself to the mast so he couldn't control the ship because, well, you're going to answer that one. I'm just setting up the problem. And finally, here's my last slide, and I promise, how did we get to this state where we have this, I believe, very mistaken notion that shareholders own firms, that they are supposed to get all, oh, I forgot to tell you why shareholders don't get all the profits, but anyone who's been on a corporation knows the answer to that. Shareholders get dividends if and only if the directors declare them. And they get an appreciation in stock price if and only if the directors decide to retain the earnings instead of paying them out for an executive jet or for philanthropic donations or for better health benefits for the employees or for something else. So it turns out it's the directors who decide whether the shareholders get a return on their investment, not the shareholders, so they're not residual claimants. So how did we get to this mistaken point? I think the answer is something like this. We began to think of corporations as all alike, and the fact is they're not. And there are, in fact, tremendous difference between corporations based on just how much power shareholders really have by virtue of their ability to vote out the directors. When you are the shareholder of a company and you are the sole shareholder, you have enormous power. I think it's fair to say then you own that firm, you control that firm, and you're the sole residual claimant if you want to be. And that's Mars Company and Hershey's. I don't know what it is with candy, but they're both privately held. I was lucky enough at the ladies' luncheon today to be sitting next to the CEO of Fiji Water. And so, you know, that's got a controlling shareholder, so, or a single shareholder, so you can certainly say they own Fiji Water. But as ownership in the firm gets more dispersed, we're there? Okay, you end up over here, Apple, Coca-Cola, GE, where there is no single shareholder who owns more than 10%. We're in different territory. Ulysses is firmly bound to the mast at this point. It could go further. You could become the Aspen Institute or the Sloan Foundation, at which point you have no shareholders at all, and they're really powerless. It's complete board control. But now I'm done, and I'm going to leave it to the rest of the panel to describe or discuss, is this a problem? Shareholders have been powerless since the public firm first arose, at least at the turn of the century. And, you know, there were periods there when the American public corporation seemed to do pretty well. So is this a problem now, or maybe is greater shareholder power the source of the problem and the short-termism and not the solution? Okay.
I mean, the role I'm playing here, I guess, is sort of the outsider. I mean, people here have been working on this issue for a long time. And I guess the reason I can comment on this is because I was sitting in those seats about 2 years ago. And I've kind of transferred into this seat just, well, just because I asked to be here. But also because of the work I've done recently. And the work I did was this book called End of the Line, The Rise and Coming Fall of the Global Corporation. And Lynn ended by asking the question, is it a problem that the shareholders, you know, don't really have that much power? And I would guess, you know, in these cases, in a number of cases, the answer, in my view, is yes. And the reason that it's a problem is not in the same reason that perhaps you guys would see it as a problem or various people in the audience. The problem is that in this situation, we have created these entities in which there is no one exercising any ownership over the activity, over the organization whatsoever. So what happened is that, you know, we've been treating the shareholder as owner, but that's, as Lynn made very clear, is the wrong way to treat the shareholder. But that means that in the process of sort of actually in recent years empowering the shareholder as owner, one of the things we've done is we've disempowered other people who actually in some ways were better able to exercise ownership control over these institutions which provide services and goods for us. So one of the problems right now is that we see is that the way power is exercised through the shareholders, through their agents, the executives, one of the results in case after case is the destruction of the assets within these corporations. The assets being, well, you know, we hear about, you know, assets, you could regard wages, high wages as an asset. You can certainly regard pension funds as an asset. You know, generally, that's of value for the society as a whole. But also, we're seeing the destruction of machinery. We're seeing the destruction of skills. I mean, one of the things about outsourcing is you're taking an activity that you've controlled, you've owned, you have people who you've trained, and you're in some ways you're just hiring someone else to do that. Offshoring, it's an asset of value, I mean, an activity that's of real value that we have had here in the United States. When you offshore it, you're actually destroying it locally. You're relying on someone else to do it. When you add up these kind of destruction of these activities again and again and again in multiple systems, in these corporate systems, eventually you end up with all sorts of really key important activities being done in one or two places far away. And this is how I got to it, because this brings to my book, because my book is started off by looking at how the global production system, as it has evolved over the past 15 years, it has evolved to a point where you have certain things that are done in certain places around the world. Certain things are done in South Korea, certain things in Taiwan, certain things in South India, certain things in China. A problem with that kind of system is that if you ever lose access to one of those geographies, you cause massive disruptions in these systems. So just to, you know, move on to the next step, the reality of having a system which no one has the power to own, no one has the power to block, no one has the power to say this is really important, is the result of that is you end up with a system in which these assets, these productive assets, which we rely on to provide us with our food and our medicines and our clothing and our machines, become severely degraded. And the way the globalization has played out has resulted in the degradation, in some cases the extreme degradation, of systems on which we rely. And just to move on, if you just look at what has happened with food systems, you know, what we found out through this pet food crisis, the way power is exercised through this system, one of the things that ended up with, we ended up with certain activities done mainly and only in China. All of our vitamins come from China, all of our ascorbic acid, all of our wheat gluten, or 80% of our wheat gluten. So, you know, if you had a system in which you had actual ownership, that wouldn't have happened. People have said, hey, there's a problem here.
I'm going to bring it briefly back to the mountain and then open it up. How many of you were here yesterday afternoon for that amazing array of conversations in the tent? I mean, there was probably a moment at which we were, you know, relishing the fact of the kind of green corporation, listening to John Doerr talk about what's possible when we turn our investment capital to promising technologies. We're surrounded up here by hybrids, you know, I love riding around in these hybrid Lexus. And we have books, green to gold, on all of the bookshelves. And then we got to Tom Friedman. And Tom Friedman presented a slightly darker view, for those of you who just joined us this morning, pointing out that the extent to which energy policy in the U.S. is lagging tremendously the radical changes that we're going to need if we're going to actually be able to do anything about the warming of the planet. And really, I thought very clearly from where he sat, put his finger right on the kind of power of the legacy industries in Washington and their lobbyists as being the reason that we haven't been able to move forward in this country. So those are kind of two ends of the spectrum. So in other words, as one of my favorite consultants says, is a system perfectly designed for the results we have now? If we want a different system, if we want different results, we're gonna have to design a different system. So, gentlemen and lady, Milton Friedman, do we have a problem? I mean, are corporations structured in a way that we can move forward and solve some of these complex problems?
Well,
Let me open it up to Bob. Do you want to go first?
Well, I'm glad to. I'm very grateful for your classical allusion. I've always thought I was Don Quixote, but it's very nice to think of Ulysses. It's a rather romantic image. And Beth and Judah, thank you so much for giving time in this very crowded schedule for a subject that we obviously think is very important. And I realized the time was going to be extremely short. I didn't know how short it was going to be. So I did. I brought with me a manuscript that will be published in the fall, of which I think there are enough copies out there for everybody. If there are not, and you still want one, give me your card and I'll send one to you. But the deal is, you've got to tell me what you think of it. I mean, you know, I've still got a chance to change a few things. But there, basically, we're at the end of a period of time right now. And it is basically Mike Jensen who predicted it. Mike wrote an article that deserves the classification that everything after Mike's article, called He Hates It, The Eclipse of the Public Corporation, has been different because of Mike's article. And what's happened is that the period, we've had an illusion of governance. Directors who don't direct, shareholders who don't own, independent directors who are only independent in the mind of lawyers who don't think that being part of a self-perpetuating group eliminates any possible credibility of independence. These governance failures have translated themselves into the marketplace. We now have private equity. And we have private equity because the failure of governance has detracted from the value of the firm. And private equity, in this wonderfully flexible world we live in, has seen an opportunity to make a profit. So they buy the firm, they straighten out the governance problems. This is a perfectly wonderful sort of, you know, John Schumpeter creative destruction, add in, fix it. Except what happens is there's a huge transfer of wealth that takes place. And the people who are done out are the shareholders of the public company, the pensioners, the mutual fund holders, and the people who are done in are the financiers who increasingly make more and more money because they are, after all, adding value. So the system really isn't that healthy, even though the result is a pretty good one. Now, you would think that this would create a situation in view of the fact that 70% of the shareholders of American companies are trustees. And because the trustees are so negligent in enforcing governance, they're lowering the value of the company. The value is going to the private equity people, not to their beneficiaries. You'd think somebody would be compelled, either by government or by lawsuit, to do something. Sorry. Don Quixote's had a hell of a hard time on this one. 20 years in, and no progress. So we now are in a situation that is very clear. We have no real governance. We have private equity to, in effect, be a marketplace, a discipline on this. And the trouble is that we're going the wrong way. The level of shareholder anger and effective involvement is increasing. I mean, I, for example, have gone for 10 years to the Exxon annual meeting in order to ask that they consider changing, having a separate chairman of the board. Maybe we have the next chairman of the board here. And this year I got 40% of the vote. Next year, I'll probably get 50% of the vote because there have been a couple of reforms that have been quite ironic that have increased the total. But this is headed in the wrong direction. It is not sensible to try and maximize values by having a confrontational relationship. The relationship ought to be a cooperative relationship. So the next stage is we're either going to be more and more and more destructive, which I don't think we can afford to be, or we're going to find some leadership way of getting a cooperative relationship between the increasingly active shareholders and the management. At the moment, we're impeded by really the 100-pound gorilla. And the 100-pound gorilla is executive compensation. And executive compensation is a subject that has raised a reasonable thought in people's minds that the purpose for running American companies is to enrich the principal executives. And unhappily, it's an area where there's been no leadership. And we desperately need leadership in this subject. Assuming we can get it on an ongoing basis, we're quite well set up now with shareholders with an increasing awareness of their obligation to act for the beneficiaries. And we could move on to a state of a healthy equilibrium of power between ownership and management that, ironically enough, rather accords with the same political solution that the founding fathers had. Whereas we don't really know the answer, but we know it's good to have power offset by countervailing power. So with any luck, that's where we'll be.
Mike, let's turn to you.
No, I think we have a problem. I thought we've had a problem for a long time. And my fellow panelists have represented it in different ways. I think we are moving in the right direction. Question is, are we moving fast enough? And in the direction we're going, will it self-destruct? So back in 1988, I gave congressional testimony at the time that hostile takeovers and leverage buyouts were very controversial. And I argued in that testimony, which was later published in an academic journal in the Harvard Business Review, as Bob said, published it under the title, The Eclipse of the Corporation. And what I argued was that we were seeing, because of the inefficiencies of the corporate form that both, that everybody's talked about in some ways, and that you basically had CEOs who weren't controlled by anybody. The CEO in the modern corporation doesn't have a boss. We pretend he has a boss. They pretend he has a boss. They pretend they have a boss. But the outside directors, not to speak of the inside directors, and virtually all corporations behave as and see themselves as, with one small exception I'll make, as the employees of the CEO. He appoints them, he dismisses them. When does that break down? It breaks down when there's a scandal that threatens their own personal reputations. And then the board becomes a boss. But it's usually way too late. It shouldn't have happened. It shouldn't have gotten that far. So in 1988, in that testimony and a year later in those papers, I pointed out that there was a new model of general management and of organizational structure, corporate structure, arising. And it was arising in two places. We called what I labeled LBO associations in those days. That was Kohlberg, Kravis, Roberts, and a few others like that, who were buying publicly held companies, levering them up, small amounts of leverage. They finance themselves with limited partnerships. They're the general partners. They are the bosses of the CEOs. There's no doubt about it. And that has, there's an interesting story to be told there. And my prediction at that time was that we were going to see this organizational form grow much more widely throughout the economy because it had all kinds of efficiencies, and even including the debt, if you look at it right, provides us a whole set of incentives. It can be misused. So now we're seeing that prediction made, what, 17, 18 years ago, becoming a very large fraction of the worldwide economy, not just the American economy. And now there's almost no major corporation that can't be taken over by a private equity firm. Why do we call them private equity? Because the other arm of this, so leveraged buyout associations made their way in old line, inefficient corporations that were growing slowly and wasting huge amounts of what I called free cash flow and destroying enormous amounts of wealth. On the other end of the spectrum, so this LBOs arrived, arose to solve that problem. On the other end of the spectrum was arising the venture capital firms that were structured in almost the identical way, except they didn't use debt, or not very much of it. Instead, substituted stage capital investments to perform that function, and were at the very high growth, small end of the market, the brand new firms. And it's proved to be, and it was unknown anywhere else in the world, either one of these organizational forms. And at that time, Bill Salmon, my colleague at Harvard, was working on venture capital, and I was, and my colleagues were working on the LBO associations, and we got together and said, my God, these things look almost identical. And they work amazingly well. Not perfect. We're never going to find a system that works perfectly. So we're now seeing that model of general management. Most of the Harvard Business School considers themselves professors of general management. I made no progress whatsoever in convincing my general management colleagues that this was a new model of general management. That's now happened. Well, now we're in a situation in which all of this has come together under the term private equity, and very large transactions are taking place. Enormous amounts of efficiency is being brought about. Bob forgot to mention, I'll quarrel with you a little bit, that the shareholders normally get on the order of 30 to 50%, 70 to 100% premiums are not at all unusual. So the old shareholders, by and large, the public shareholders are still sharing in it through, or individuals are sharing in it through their claims on insurance companies and pension funds and college endowments, which are funding these things instead of them buying the stock directly. Now there's a whole set of legal constraints that Lynn could tell us about that drives those institutional investors that Bob has for years been tilting with to behave as they should behave in principle or in theory, okay? Now, So what's happened is that we've made a lot of progress. Is it perfect? No. Here's the danger. This thing has become so successful now, private equity. It's way overvalued. It's heading for a crash. When Steve Schwarzman sells out by taking his firm public, that's a very important signal. And he's done it in a way, and his own personal behavior has done it in a way, to discredit what is a very important economic activity. More than that, we have a whole bunch of learners coming into the market, and people are flooding them with money. There's going to be very low returns. There will be major scandals over the next 2 to 5 years. This segment will get a very bad name. And if it all works out, according to my vision at least, we will survive the bad things that are going on because the very people that are doing it, and Steve Schwarzman is a part of it, now, and they do earn very superior returns. That's being funneled back to the public through the limited partnership interest. But they're actually dismantling the model of the private equity model that has worked so very well. In the past, the payouts to the general partners came in the form of equity payments plus an annual fee, equity proportional payments that were proportional to equity in the gains of the shares. Now we're finding all kinds of special payments not related to equity that the buyout firms are taking. They get paid for making deals. And the more they pay for the deals, the more they get paid. Now this is not true of all of them, but it's true of Schwarzman and Company. Okay. And there's other things like non-proportional dividends, special dividends going to the buyout specialist. This is a disaster. So we're going to get that sorted out. But in the meantime, there's going to be a lot of blood on the floor. So, yes, we're doing better. Are we going to see problems? Yes. And when we come out of that, hopefully we'll be back on track again.
All right. Damon, the modern corporation.
Well,
do we have a problem?
I mean, I think that you all have now heard from, you know, the leading lights in a whole bunch of areas. Everything that everyone said about each other is true here. Bob Monks is in many ways the founder of modern corporate governance. Mike Jensen's paper is as influential as other people have characterized it as, and you've just heard, I think, the sort of modern updating of it. And Barry's work on supply chains is, I think, very highly regarded. But the question I think that one might be left with after this is, what question are we asking here? And I will pose a question and try to give you a brief answer to it that I think is relevant to everything that just got said, I hope. And you may be surprised that my answer doesn't have anything to do with collective bargaining or with union organizing, except in the most remote kind of indirect way. I think the question that should be posed here, and it's where Judy began, is the modern corporation globally, not just in the United States, but globally, although the United States is a good place to sort of start and probably many of our reference points, is the modern corporation in its current form, in its current relationship to the capital markets, with its current governance, is that corporation going to be able to be part of, and let me say also in its current relationship with governments, is it going to be able to be a key part of the solution to some very, very serious and dramatic problems that are extant in the world, right? And just for starters, the problem of climate change. Let's just keep that one in mind as we discuss this, because as Beth said, I think at the opening here, or maybe Judy said, firms are extraordinarily powerful right now in the world in terms of resource allocation, in terms of ultimate decisions. So if it's not, right, if the answer is no, that is a very, very serious fact. And you can move on to other issues, right, whether it's healthcare in the United States, which is a crisis we have here, or fundamental issues about poverty, or you name your issue. But let's start with global warming because it's so connected to the behavior, to economic behavior. Now, and I would suggest to you that we have a big problem, and it's not really the problem. The different people have given you windows onto it, but it's not really, it hasn't really been fleshed out. And the big problem, right, is that the modern corporation, the corporation today, is increasingly governed
not by the legal structures that you just saw, either version of them, either the classical sort of principal agent description or Lynn's description of, you know, Ulysses tied to the mast and all that. Right? The corporation today is governed by an alliance. It's an alliance between executives who are paid more than corporate executives have ever been paid in modern history. Right now, are they paid more than John D. Rockefeller was paid when he owned Standard Oil? I don't know, but in terms of modern stuff, CEOs are paid more than they've ever been paid, and paid linked to relatively short-term movements in securities prices. And by relatively short-term, I mean less than 3 years. And they are in alliance with a variety of market actors whose holding periods are less than 3 years, whose horizons are less than 3 years. Right? And some of them, I think everybody knows about, right? Hedge funds, right? Hedge funds are their holding period as long as they want it to be, 10 minutes, 10 months, 10 days, often 10 minutes. Something you might not be familiar with, though, is that the typical private equity strategy, and by the way, as I think Professor Jensen laid out very nicely for you, private equity is kind of a misnomer. There are really two things going on here. One is leveraged buyouts, the other is venture capital. In relationship to our large public corporations, it's leveraged buyouts that matter, and the leveraged buyout game plan is sort of roughly a 3-year flip-em plan, in and out of the public markets. And its boom, by the way, in my opinion, has nothing at all to do with whether they're smarter than other managers or not smarter than other managers. It has everything to do with the relative price of debt and a long-term debt in the global marketplace, which has everything to do with currency imbalances and where the Chinese government chooses to put its money. That's just not just my view. That's actually the OECD's view. If you get them in a room and shut the door and ask the economists, why is debt so cheap? Why is risky debt so cheap? That's the answer. It's not because Steve Schwarzman's a genius. Although it does hearten me to know that next time someone says I'm being too mean to Steve Schwarzman, I can point to Mike Jensen. I'll be mean. The people rowing the boat are not directors, to go back to this analogy. They are this alliance between executives and short-term market players. Now, that alliance is a relatively new phenomenon. That is not the basic controlling circumstance of corporations in the 1970s or the 1950s. All right? And its power has become dramatically increased by the relative weakness of government, not just the U.S. government, but any government, in relationship to increasingly large global corporations. Now, is that kind of governance going to produce the right kind of outcomes in relationship to enormous economic challenges? Global warming, by the way, is an economic challenge. It is not an environmental challenge, although environmental challenge, it's about the environment, but it comes to a head as an economic challenge. It's not about polar bears. It's not about melting glaciers. Right? It's about foods. It's about food supplies and arable land, right? And where our cities are. And our ability to feed the planet and its current population and house the planet and its current population when seas are 15 to 20 feet higher. Now, that's what it's about. And if you look at, and when I say economic, if you look at, say, the Stern Commission report from the United Kingdom, they talk about 10 to 20% lower global GDP. That's what they're talking about. Now, can corporations governed the way I just described them respond to that challenge? Now, there is some evidence that some corporations are doing better than others at responding to it. Right? But in general, when you look around the corporate landscape, you in general see a corporate landscape which is either not dealing with it at all or pretending to deal with it but not really dealing with it. Now, how could we change that? What is a different way of governing these institutions? Now, there are different solutions, right? There is the solution of making boards and CEOs completely autonomous, right? And I don't know if you know Marty Lipton, a very thoughtful man. That's basically his solution, right? He thinks that that sort of corporate leaders are wise enough to be unaccountable to anyone. You could view leverage buyouts as a solution.
He gets paid very well for that situation, by the, for that stance.
All right.
And I will hold to that time. You could view leveraged buyouts as a solution. I don't. I view them as a cyclical phenomenon having to do with the relative price of debt and equity. All right. You could view, quote, investors or, quote, shareholders as the solution. As I indicated, I don't think that is t- tells you very much about who those shareholders are and their different time horizons. What the labor movement thinks is that it's in everyone's interest for shareholders that are genuinely long-term in their holding behavior and are genuinely diversified, that aren't playing games, right, but are in a position to absorb the full consequences of what happens and doesn't happen in the global economy.
For example?
Well, what I'm describing is large diversified pension funds, essentially. People with 30, 40 years of time horizons.
Norwegian pension
funds. Or the Norwegian State Oil Fund, for example, is an example of something like this, right, which is invested for the benefit of all Norwegians for all time. Right. Those institutions are relatively can be relatively appropriate overseers and holders of accountability, so to speak, of a corporate decision making structure. But it's not automatic. And the reason why it's not automatic is because if those institutions are for external reasons, which maybe we can get into, if those institutions' investment strategy is to seek through active management to essentially beat the market, right? And by the way, it's an illusion. You take $300 billion and you're going to beat the market with $300 billion. It just is not going to happen. But if you do it, right, then there is the danger of these institutions, the tail wagging the dog, right, of the, say, the 10% or the 15% of their holdings that are put with hedge funds and leveraged buyout firms and this kind of stuff in vain efforts to outperform the broad economy they're investing in, driving their thinking across their whole portfolio. So that what we, in the end, are talking about is a problem that is more than a problem of the way corporations are governed, but it's a problem of all the way all these institutions interact with each other. I would suggest, though, that that type of investor is still part of the accountability solution. And I would finally suggest, and my time has run out, that the one thing that's very clear is that an alliance between very short-term marginal traders and corporate executives with 2 and 3 year terms of tenure, right, as the key people who will decide where the majority of the wealth, what the majority of the wealth and power and intellectual capital in this world does, is extremely unlikely to produce good outcomes in relationship to problems like climate change.
We're now going to open this up. I don't mean yet to you. Hang on to your thoughts. Let's go at it. Responses, Lynn, I know Barry wants to get in here, but go quick and cut somebody off if they're going too long.
First of all, I'm just astonished that we all radically disagree with each other, but this has been a very useful conversation, and I've actually learned something from it, or had some ideas, and one of my ideas is, okay, you don't like the guys who've been rowing the boat. You don't like the directors and the executives. You don't trust them. Bob, in particular, wants to unleash Ulysses and let him drive the boat. But Damon is concerned, as am I. Ulysses is listening to those stupid sirens. The reason why Ulysses tied himself to the boat, the reason why shareholders have not run public firms in the United States, until recently at most, is because they do listen to these short-term pressures. So if we're going to unleash Ulysses, let's focus our attention on fixing the institutions that drive what shareholders do. And I think that would be a very useful area. Why do I sit on the board of a mutual fund? Okay, my mutual fund turns over its shares on average every year. And it does that for institutional reasons, not because the fund managers don't care about global warming, not because they can't see.
The institutional reason being?
They have to report quarterly results, which are followed very closely. They are not allowed to take very large positions in companies. They have to be diversified, which makes it irrational for them to get too involved in the long-term future. There are tax laws that make it advantageous to turn your portfolio. It's a complicated problem.
We'll stick with Ulysses and the siren song. I really have a very optimistic answer. And the question is, what's the tune of the song? Now, managers are not bad people. I've been a manager. I've run companies. People run according to what is the requirement put on them. The question is our accounting language. Now, if we had a system of accounting that properly recorded costs, like the cost of environmental depredation, if we had the costs of bad labor practices, the cost of putting people out of work, the cost of mental health care for workers who are doing repetitive work. If we had an accounting system, and look, this isn't just crazy. The present accounting system, there isn't a human being in the world who has a good word to say for the present accounting system. So we need a new accounting system. Now, how we're ever going to get it, I don't know.
Beth, more comment?
Actually, I think we were kind of missing somewhat the extent of the crisis, and I somewhat disagree with Professor Tension that we're actually moving in the right direction. Bob a while ago said that he's been working on this for 20 years, and it's actually, this has been a question that people have been dealing with for a lot longer than 20 years. Bob actually mentioned before he quoted Schumpeter on, the idea that capitalism is a process of creative destruction. That was from this book, which is Capitalism, Socialism, and Democracy. But there's a sort of passage in here which, I wanted to just put out there because it kind of, I think it's sort of the existential passage about, American capitalism. And it's like, the capitalist process, by substituting a mere parcel of shares for the walls of and the machines in a factory, takes the life out of the idea of property. It loosens the grip that once was so strong. The grip in the sense of the legal right and the actual ability to do as one pleases with one's own. The grip also in the sense that the holder of the title loses the will to fight economically, physically, politically for his factory and his control over it, to die if necessary on its steps. There was a crisis in capitalism that was perceived by Schumpeter. That was 1942. You could sort of trace it back to Berlin Mines, 1932. You could trace it somewhat back to Veblen. You could trace it back to Marshall in the late 19th century. There's a sense that shareholder capitalism in and of itself holds the seed of its own destruction. And what happened, we managed to avert that crisis in the 1930s and 1940s and into the 1980s because we created other forms of ownership. We created the Roosevelt administration sort of imposed unions in a big way on industry. That was a form of ownership. Unions were able to block, they were able to hold on to the machines. They said, you guys cannot take this away. There was a period, managers remained, they were not optioned, they were salaried. It was a very different function when you had salaried professional management. They had an interest in the long-term maintenance of this institution. They were not in it for 3 years and then out with their gazillions of dollars. You had the state. The other thing was the state was involved. The state during the Cold War, during the Second World War and the Cold War, was at the table making sure that we were actually increasing production, maintaining the system, because we needed this apparatus for use in war.
Okay, we're going to shift to solution space here. I'm going to just put one question out there, and I just want, phrases are fine, fragments are fine, just your immediate response to this. You are benevolent dictator of modern capitalism for a day. What would put your finger on the pulse of the one thing you think you would change? And let's just go down the row, starting with you, Barry. Where would you put your focus today? And then I want to open it up for more discussion with everyone in the room.
I would make it so that whatever a professional, a manager is able to take off the table, they have to wait 10 years, and it's based on the value of the company after 10 years.
Everybody get that? Want to repeat it?
That for the manager of the company, whatever benefit they get from the value of the stock that they might be given as it's because you do want some ownership stake perhaps in management, but that they're not able to, that money is something that they have to leave on the, they do not get that for 10 years.
So they have to, in other words, they're investing forward, they have to see what the payout is over a period of time to make sure that what they did today actually is rewarded, still
Well, corporations, as they're currently configured and as they're changing, can make some movements towards solving the global climate problem. But that's a classic example of that economists know to be an externality, because, and Tom Friedman explained it very well yesterday, it cannot be solved in the private sector. It's a policy problem. It has to be solved by the guy with the gun who's setting the rules of the game. I don't happen to like that.
He said.
That is the government.
That's not what he said, but anyway, we can disagree
well,
on that one.
he said it, policy. He's talking about, he talked a little more than I did about how you get that change to happen, the government to make those changes in the rules of the game. But it has to come at that level. True. And it is the major problem we're facing right now. So let's not fool ourselves. It cannot be solved at the level of you and I. We can contribute to it. Mm-hmm. The solution, and it's got to be a global rule.
So what would you do with the modern corporation? Or you're saying it's working?
I'm saying that it's working.
It's working.
If you want this problem solved, don't look to the corporation. Now that's a really important problem. Get it off the table.
Would you agree then the corporation should not be influencing that policy?
Of course not.
Okay.
Wouldn't agree
Lynn?
With that.
90% tax rate on the increase in the value of any investment held for only a year. And the tax rate decreased.
Repeat that again.
I want a 90% tax rate on income from any asset held for only a year. Each year you hold it, the tax rate goes down by 10%. This rule applies to individuals, pension funds, everybody.
So basically, work with the tax system to advantage.
If you bought it,
holders.
You got to keep it for a while.
Bob?
All right. Enforcement of the legal obligations of the trustees who own 70% of the stock of all public companies so that we can apply the ancient fiduciary laws for long-term thinking and have that enforceable by different categories of trustee.
Okay, everybody get that?
That really addresses the holders and the trustees there. You're not talking about the corporation then.
I'm talking about the shareholders. I'm talking about the shareholders.
You're talking about the teacher's retirement and annuity board.
I am talking about responsible owners who control a corporation, not just taking dividends, but exercising responsible ownership, the same way we do in private companies that we own. We don't have responsible owners today.
And Bob, whether or not you voted 90%, would you tip the cap gains rate to advantage longer-term holders?
No, I wouldn't fool around with it.
Damon?
90% is a little extreme, but you got the idea.
Hey, this is the Aspen Ideas Festival, folks. Let's get some new thoughts on
But one thing everybody gets confused about there are people who spin it around. But 40% of stock of corporations is held permanently in index funds. People don't advertise it because the fees aren't very big. But 40% is held, so 40% is permanent stockholding.
40% of institutional ownership, not total.
Oh, I think it's total, isn't it?
No, because it's 20% of total.
Sorry about that.
Okay, 20%.
Still a big chunk.
Still a big difference.
Damon? I should just note, because it's just very entertaining, that Barry's idea was the single most controversial idea, not exactly in his form, but very similar, was the single most controversial idea that made it into the Aspen Long-Term Principles.
Which are all in the back of the room. Please pick them up when you exit. They're on the right side.
My idea would be, and I don't think it solves everything by any means, but my idea would be, and it's apropos of what I was saying, that it ought to be fairly easy for long-term holders to elect directors and very, very hard for short-term holders to do so.
Mm-hmm.
If you do one thing in relation to corporate governance, that's what I think we would favor. I do think, though, it's worth pointing out that the paradigm that I advanced in my early remarks about what will enable the global corporate community to address global warming assumes that one way or another, right, because of both their direct power and because of their influence over the political system, that if the global corporate community resists doing something about global warming with its full strength, right, that nothing will be done, not by corporations and not by government.
Bob Reich used to say that the benefit that corporations should be able to have in terms of being able to exercise their voice clearly is that they would not use that voice in terms of being able to buy . He said that should be the quid pro quo.
I mean, look, anybody who lives inside the Beltway knows that buying influence is the name of the game.
Let's open it up and go to the back of the room, please. We'll keep the motion of trying to stay brief on comments and questions. Yes.
I'd like to ask the panel to comment on information systems as related to shareholder and ownership responsibility. Mm-hmm. Bob Monks, he talked briefly about accounting, and that's one of the information systems we have. What are the others that shareholders maybe should have in the corporation of the future to be able to make better decisions?
Two quick answers from you in the group here? Damon?
Well,
and then Barry.
I mean, the point about accounting is really, really important. All right, the accounting system right now is being revised in the United States and revised at a global level. All right, and it's moving, the people who are doing the revising, by and large, are moving that accounting system away from historic cost accounting to essentially mark-to-market accounting. Right, and it's a move that echoes what Barry was talking about this move away from actual things and actual production processes to essentially the securitization of the financialization, not just of things, but of information. All right. The notion of moving to the accounting system that Bob Monks was talking about, where you kind of internalize externalities, where you have an accounting system in it, and behind that accounting system would have to be some kind of very, very complex
information
system of the kind you're asking, to capture what the full consequences are of economic decisions, not just within the corporation narrowly, but more broadly. That would be a very good thing to have, but there's no sign of it. And in fact, I would suggest that at the moment, our accounting system is moving in a direction that will accentuate what I view as being wrong with the current system of corporate governance.
All right, I think we'll do that. Yes, please. Yeah. Just stand up and tell us who you are. I'm sorry, I should have asked you.
Yeah, I'm Alan Questman. I've had the opportunity to run several corporations, and it amazes me the perception on the outside of how they run. There's no question there's some extremes, and we focused on probably 10 of them in the last 5 years in terms of what's happened. But I want to take you back a few years, and you start writing some of your papers. But back in the 1980s, and by the way, it should be known that most public corporations are owned by 20 funds. They own about 70% of the stock of our company. So it's not like it's little misses over here and little misses over there. It's run by a very few number of people. They play a very active role involved with the board and with the CEO in terms of what goes on in that company. The criticism of corporate pay is a direct result, in most cases, of what was asked by those funds back in the 1980s.
Yes.
And what they said is that they believe that the only way a corporation can run is that the management of that company have to be heavily invested in equity. They had no care about the income that they were paid as long as the stock performed on the short term. Most of those funds are interested in short-term returns. Very few, there are some that are long-term players. But for the most part, the person investing in those funds wants to know, how did I do this year? Did I pick up 10? Did I pick up 20%? And if I don't get 20%, I'm going to move my money to another fund. So I think when people are harshly critical of the board or the CEOs and the board are reflective of who the owners of the company are, which are these less than 20%, 20 people or 20 funds who own 70% of the stock. And they play, whether we like it or not, they play a very active role. And I would argue if the board responded to the vote of those people totally, it would be even more reflective of short-term results versus longer-term. And we would have industries all overseas. And I think you have a lot of corporate leaders who really are interested not only in the profitability of the company, but the profitability of America, and that people are employed, and that we are using the money properly to advance issues in our country.
I don't see much disagreement up here. I see a lot of nodding heads, Damon.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. You just said what I said, it just in different words.
I do think the flavor comes out that it's these corporate guys make all this money, and that nobody cares about what the shareholder says. And I don't think that's true. I think it's totally exaggerated.
No, what I would say in response to you is that my experience in talking with leaders of corporate America, in both medium-sized and very large companies, is that you accurately describe their basic mentality, but that they are increasingly less able to act on those instincts, mm-hmm. right? In the world you described, in the world in which
I don't agree with that at all.
Well,
I think that's an absolute exaggeration.
Well,
it's absolutely.
Perhaps.
I think they're more responsive now, and they're changing the course because people have changed their priorities.
But what I'm saying
responsive
is
responsive to who?
To the owners of that company.
Well,
now, as long as those shareholders are 70%,
calling them owners might be the wrong.
They are the people who own the stock. And quite frankly, the way the stock works, if you don't like it, you can sell the stock, and that stock's going to drop, and that affects everybody. And by the way, the average corporate executive today, CEO, is less than 5 years. It used to be 10 years. So there's lots of pressure on these guys and gals.
3 years, just for the record. Mike, do you want to say anything about executive comp?
It's a mess.
Just, I apologize if this is too granular, but it goes back to the accounting issue. Specifically, the trend with KKR and Blackstone, I'd be interested in your, in the panel's position on the transparency and governance of the public to private to back to public in terms of these large companies that are going to be rolling out. I'd be very interested in ISS.
I can tell it to you. You weren't old enough to really appreciate what I'm going to say. Goldman Sachs Trading Company, revisited. I mean, this is something that historians will write about, and they will say, what were you doing? These are people who are selling stock to the public based on earnings that aren't just based on getting revenue, they're based on exceeding the market. I mean, this is like Wobegon going crazy. I mean, everybody exceeds, so they've been exceeding the market for some years, so they go public on that basis, so people buy stock on that basis. Now, what happens when absolutely certainly they don't outperform? All the projections don't go this way, they go this way. Stock goes down, everything goes down, everybody has to start liquidating, and you have Goldman Sachs Trading Company revisited. And we're just sitting here with our thumbs in our mouths.
Yeah, I would suggest in response to your question that anyone who can take a look at the balance sheet in each of the five versions of the Blackstone IPO document, and not understand what those assets are, because no one can understand, you can't understand what the assets are, but understand why it is that in the five versions of the IPO document, when the business is exactly the same, right, the assets and the balance sheet fluctuate by more than $10 billion across the five different drafts of the document, right? And there's no change in what the business is, there's no change in the economics, it's just that the balance sheet numbers moved as much as $10 billion in different directions as they tried to worm their way through both the accounting system and the SEC system and the tax system and have everything the way they wanted it in every case as they went through it. Mm-hmm. And they were aided and abetted in this completely, completely opaque document. All right? They were aided and abetted by the way in which the accounting system has moved from a historic cost to a mark-to-market basis. And I'll give you just one clue if you want to try, right? Which is that they capitalize future carried interest, right? And if you think about that in terms of what Bob Munz just said, capitalizing future carried interest is sort of the ultimate in a kind of
Enron. Enron's been the whipping boy, and they use mark-to-market accounting.
Exactly.
They did.
They were capitalizing future deals that had not $1 of revenue.
And so
where are we, folks?
Yeah. Ask Bob Hurst that question.
I put it very simply. The publicly held private equity firm is a non sequitur, not only in English, but in economics. It will fail.
Yeah. You're absolutely right.
It will fail. They are giving up the very things that enabled them to outperform the old governance system. And it's unbelievable. Two things, greed coupled with stupidity.
Two questions in one.
Statement is, if you guys are sitting here 10 years from now, will you have the same discussions as you're having today?
No.
I sure hope not. That suggests a very flat learning curve.
The second thing relating to the current LBO billion-dollar bulge we're having is that I was talking this morning to a very, very prominent LBO operator, but he's not in the billion-dollar class, so I said, how are these things going to work out? He says, I'll guarantee you the operators will make billions.
Yeah.
But I can't tell you what the investors are going to make.
Right.
If anything.
Right.
One of the themes that seems to be prevalent is the issue of long-term versus short-termism. And I was talking to David Blood of Generation Investment Management Group, and he was talking about the Marathon group, and I was wondering if anybody on the panel was aware of that and if they felt like that there were that was any part of the solution. I mean, to be brief, it's about taking, if you're an investment management firm, and taking a longer-term view and making a commitment of a longer-term holding period by investment management.
Anybody against long-term?
I'm not going to be against it, but I think what we need to understand is, and normally I'm a pretty liberal free market person, liberal in the economic sense, but I think what we need to understand is that investors and I'm including myself in this group, we need to be protected against our own worst instincts. Without some sort of mechanism, whether it's graduated voting rights or a declining capital gains rate, whatever it is, investors will inevitably follow what they think is the hot, the money will be hot money. Absent some institutional change, if you just tell people, they will chase the next investment fad. They always have. I don't see any evidence that that is going to change unless we create a legal system that encourages people, rewards long-term holding.
There isn't really so much question of the deferral of the executives' pay. If you deferred the pay of the money managers, now, I don't know a single money management firm in the world that has compensation other than possibly Generation, and they're starting something. But I've worked for a number of investment firms with an effort to create long-term funds. And I have, you know, I've been asked to leave the room at the end of the year when I've said, gee, folks, it looks to me like everybody here is getting paid on the 1231 value. And, you know, these are really nice people who are really genuine reformers, but they're stuck to that system. Until we can change that system, the kind of pressures, the abuses that you're talking about will continue to exist.
Mm-hmm. Judy, can I just 1 second? I think the key thing to understand about, you know, the formation of long-term funds is that there will always be short-term and long-term investors, and there's nothing wrong with there being short-term investors. They provide valuable liquidity. The question is, who should be calling the shots in real companies?
Mm-hmm. Right.
And who should be just along for the ride?
Yeah, well, maybe
I like his idea better than
mine. Well, you know, maybe
I'm
you want.
I'm trading in my tax for his voting rights.
Well, I mean, one thing I'm continually struck by is the fact that we seem to be looking at these corporations as mechanisms for the manufacture of cash. And fundamentally, a corporation is an entity which we have created. It's a governance, it's a piece of government that we created to manufacture things for us, provide services for us, and the ones that do the best job, we're going to, you know, be able to take home a profit. But that's, you know, that's third or fourth down the line. The purpose of these organizations is to provide things for us and to provide services for us. And some of us might think that it's to provide jobs. Some of us might think it's to provide certain government services, like, they do collect taxes for the government. And one of the things that if we follow that line of reasoning, we can also begin to say, well, how could we use these incredibly powerful institutions to do things like fight global warming?
It's a different concept.
Yeah. It's a different concept, but we're not going to get there through this conversation. In fact, maybe this conversation
you'd
is
have
a distraction.
You'd have to have different owners.
And if you do get there, it will be an unmitigated disaster.
We can at least say, what can we do to make corporations not make the problem worse? So you're right. Ultimately, it's a government function, but we can at least have a system that doesn't make it worse.
Right. I think we may well turn in the future to having two classes of stock, ownership stock and trading stock. And I think that may well be the answer.